Yes, welcome to The Minefield. This is the program where we try to make our way through the moral dilemmas and traps of modern life. And modern life, I don't know about you, but it feels a bit exhausting at the moment. I mean, it's only February, and already some of us are just feeling, I don't know, a little bit despondent, maybe looking back ruefully at the holidays that we did or didn't have. So we've decided to devote today's show to, well, is an ethical holiday still possible? We want to try to lighten the mood, I suppose, a little bit after the heaviness of the last 2 weeks and see whether this particularly fraught but unfortunately rather unreflective aspect of modern life is something that can be redeemed. I'm Scott Stevens, of course. My co-host is, well, he's already rather illustrious, but he's a bit more illustrious today than he was yesterday, aren't you, my friend? Waleed Ali is now, of course, Dr. W. After his doctoral thesis. Yeah, I'm trying to make it stick. I don't feel like it's going to work, but still.
I feel like I'm meant to bust out some rhymes or something.
I know. Dr. Wu, I think is the... his doctoral thesis was, of course, passed by his examiners after much cajoling and, from what I understand, a little bit of bribery as well. But still, what's a little bit of bribery between academic friends, right?
Now, I was going to say, don't mention this, it's embarrassing, but now you got my backup. Now I have to defend myself. this is quite a strategy. Thank you for your congratulations off air, even if they stand in stark contrast to your needling on air.
Oh, come on. Look, having read your thesis, it is astonishing. It is astonishing. And I think one of the nice things about it is, you know, the Waleed that we see on Channel 10, the Waleed we even hear on The Minefield. I mean, I like to think that this is the real you. But then reading your thesis, I think this is the real man. This is where this guy lives. It's fabulous stuff.
Oh, well, I'm sure that's a review of one person and perhaps no more, or at least two examiners. Let's hope that was the case. I'm glad we're talking about holidays today because this is, to be clear, and just in the interest of declaration, this is something that I suggested we talk about a couple of weeks ago, and then Australia Day got in the way and the moral quandaries associated with that, and then Donald Trump appeared, and God knows that got in the way. So this is kind of our first chance to try to break free a little bit of the news cycle, although there is an argument, there are certainly other things to talk about. But I had this idea, Scott, on holiday, as it happens. I was overseas over the summer break, and I went to a holiday. We stayed in a holiday resort. And when I say a resort, I mean all the things that you would expect. It's planted on a beach. There are about 12 swimming pools involved. There are high-class restaurants serviced by probably Michelin star chefs. I wouldn't know, to be honest. But it was exactly what you imagine it to be. And I had this feeling of intense discomfort with it. And discomfort's the wrong word, actually, because it's a very comfortable place. But I felt ill at ease. And I didn't know what it was. And I thought initially it was just because that's not the style of holiday I do. I like to go out and see things. If you put me next to a pool and I just get agitated by it, right? So originally I thought it was just that. But then it sort of hit me. We were overseas in Sri Lanka, as it happened. And as we left the resort, it occurred to me that I was seeing this city that may as well not have existed. And then a really horrifying thought struck me, and that was that I'm not convinced that these kinds of resorts in these kinds of destinations are morally justifiable. And that seems an extreme position to reach, but it hit me like this. This is a hermetically sealed fantasy land that we create that allows primarily first world tourists, such as myself, to go and enjoy the resources that a developing world country, like in this case Sri Lanka, has. That is a stunning beach, for example. To enjoy that without actually having to confront anything to do with life in that country, anything to do with those societies. In fact, it's in its way aggressively uninterested in anything that local culture might have to offer, except for the sort of tokenistic ceremonies that you might find as you walk in. There are people sitting around a drum making some noise, singing some songs as a form of welcome. But even that, Scott, I found troubling because it was like, well, that's even worse. That's kind of selling the illusion that we are interested in the culture of the host society when we're not, when we're doing everything we can to prevent this kind of interaction. The gate that goes into the resort is sealed off. You have to go past a security guard in order to get in. If I was staying at a luxury hotel even, across the road from a beach, even then I would have to leave the front door of the hotel. I would have to cross the road. I might see, I don't know, some street food vendors, or I might see some kind of tiny little pixel of local life, and I might see something that I don't particularly like, or that confronts me, or that I have to get used to, or something. I might, there is at least the chance of that. But the resort, what the resort is doing is it is saying, we want nothing other than your resources. We don't want you, we don't want your culture, we don't want your people, except perhaps in this role of servitude. And in that way, I couldn't escape the feeling it was kind of a neo-colonial institution, completely uninterested in the knowledge about other cultures, completely uninterested in dealing in a constructive way or in a receptive way to other cultures, and interested only in the plundering of resources, even if they are renewable. I think I got that off my chest.
Wow, fabulous, fabulous. See, we so should have done this a couple of weeks ago. Now, this is wonderful, because, of course, the economic model that sustains colonialism is the model of extractive colonialism, where the sites exist insofar as those sites can be mined and the wealth, if you like, can be extracted and sent back to, you know, whatever economic center there might be. But what you're describing is almost a form of experientially extractive colonialism, where the experience is there to be had, to be mined, but only insofar as the experience is itself already commodified, or the culture that is able to be interacted with has already been so emaciated, so commodified, so turned into something where you can have the, if you like, faint whiff of exoticism, but without the contamination that might go along with that.
And it's the fact that it's a self-contained world that allows that, right? So it's not just the fact that it's nice rooms and a pool and a beach. It's the fact that it's 12 restaurants.
Okay. Now, hang on. Because there are two alibis, though, that are often mounted to try to assuage your guilt. Let me have a go at these. One is, these resorts assist local economies. All they have to offer, really, the first world is tourism. And so by you going there, you are assisting the local economy. That's alibi number one.
Do you want me to talk to that first?
One moment. Right. Alibi number two is in many ways the more interesting one, it seems to me. And that's that, okay, let's just say that you feel a little bit conflicted, as you obviously were, about being there. How about the resort organizes for you a day trip out into some somewhat impoverished area for you to indulge in a little bit of, say, volunteer work, or what's sometimes called volunteering. That way you can go out, get your hands dirty, and feel better while you're sitting around table being served by a Michelin star chef that night. What do you, seriously, Waleed, what do you make of these two alibis? Because it seems to me that the purpose of both is to try to overcome any residual sense of guilt.
Yeah, I feel like we're emphasizing the idea of poverty a little too much. It's not about wanting to live amongst poverty or anything like that. And there's, you know, Sri Lanka is not a country I would describe as deeply impoverished or anything like that.
No, probably the term, probably authentic culture or sort of local authenticity is probably the better point.
Okay.
You're right.
All right. So two things I'd say. Let's take the first thing, the economic argument. I don't doubt that there are locals that make money out of this, although I don't claim to have inspected their labor contracts. I don't know what they're getting paid or if they're getting exploited. But let's assume that it's actually economically quite lucrative for them. To me, that only gives further shape to the problem. It articulates the contours of the problem better. Because all that's saying is we are prepared to pay a premium not to have to interact, not to have to engage. If we genuinely cared, or even if we accepted that part of the quid pro quo of going on a holiday was some level of engagement, like that's just kind of, that's the deal that you get when you go to enjoy another place, is you actually have something to do with that place. If we genuinely believed, or we genuinely cared about locals, local culture, all that sort of thing, then we could still have luxury, but in a way that was far more interactive, that wasn't a Disneyland for adults or perhaps for families, right? It would be possible to create these economic benefits without it being such a bubble that we are creating. And the second point, I know at these resorts they will often offer day trips to things. Oh, you'll have local cooking classes or whatever, or you might be able to go surfing at some other beach that isn't captured by the resort or whatever it might be. I understand that those sorts of things happen or that they might be offered. What I'm talking about is the ethos of the place, because it is designed so that those sorts of things actually feel like a little bit of an effort. Mm. They're highly expensive and they're often very good experiences. You might do it, but actually the whole selling point of this, of these kinds of resorts, is there's no need for you to do this. You don't need to go anywhere. You do not need anything. Everything is catered for you here. And so the idea that we would then in turn commodify the cultural experience as a separate option that you can get if you do want to escape the bubble for a couple of hours, right, while living in this world that is actually designed kind of to remove those desires from you, I have a problem with that, because yes, I actually feel like the kind of interaction I'm talking about would be the kind of thing that should be experienced just in the accidental intercourse of life. It's what happens when you need to get money from money exchange, or find an ATM, or get some food or something like that. It's those incidental interactions. I'm not pretending they're deeply rich. I'm not pretending that they will bring us world peace. I'm not pretending that there isn't something even potentially exploitative about those things, but at least it's not so aggressively uninterested. Mm. I mean, I feel like the resort is kind of like the shopping mall of the holiday world, or it's...
You know, or the food court, maybe.
Yes, or the food court. Or you know, if the Kardashians became a holiday, it would be a resort. Do you see what I mean? It's the total, almost proud lack of human interest that I think that gets me. And I don't think any of the objections you've raised counter that.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I didn't really raise them as objections. But there is one thing, and I really want to come to our guest. But can I just raise one teeny thing? Because
sure,
while resorts may seem like a kind of rarefied topic, where this is an exceptional thing that maybe we talk about when we have nothing else to talk about, there is something about what you just described that seems to me deeply symptomatic of one of the great malaises of modern moral life. And I think it goes something like this. We want to be aroused by moral concern. One of the reasons that we follow, say, foreign news reporting in Facebook or on our Twitter feeds or whatever, is we want to know what's happening elsewhere. The allure of exoticism or of otherness or of sheer cultural difference is one of the things that makes an overseas holiday, I think, attractive. It's not just more of the same. It's something different, but not so different that all we can see is the difference.
Yes.
But I think one of the things that we keep coming across with the way that ethics is sold for modern consumption is we want to be able to be aroused by a problem. But we want to be aroused by that problem in such a way that is containable, where we are non-contaminated by the problem, where we can be aroused by the problem, have an easy solution to the problem. It might be a donation. It might be a contained day trip out into some sort of authentic, quote-unquote authentic community. But then we can escape from it without being tainted by it. In other words, modern life, and this is part of the guilt-free zone of modern capitalism, I think, is that we're offered products that really feel to me like moral prophylactics. You can be aroused by it. You can get some satisfaction from it, from the donation or whatever, but ultimately you're not contaminated by it. Whereas it seems to me there is no form of ethics worth its salt. There's no form of ethical engagement that doesn't leave oneself open to being contaminated, to being vulnerable to the experience that you're exposing yourself to, and indeed having one's life change as a result. And so I think there's something here that's really symptomatic about a whole lot of different products that we indulge in. I'm not sure if that resonates with you, but I thought I'd put it out there anyway.
No, I think it's actually a really important point. I should also say, I'm quite keen to be proven wrong about this, because I will have to have another holiday at some point, and I wouldn't mind all options being on the table,
wow,
at the very least. I think my wife disagrees with me, so I may well have no choice in the matter. Anyway, you are listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website. Search for RN The Minefield to do it. Or you can tweet us at RN The Minefield.
You said at the start of the show that this is an area that, unfortunately, not a great deal of reflection, moral reflection, seems to take place. thankfully, we have someone who's actually thought incredibly deeply about this and written amazingly perceptively about it. Maria Colleth recently completed her doctoral research, would you believe it, on volunteer tourism in the Department of Gender and Cultural Studies at the University of Sydney. And she joins us from Sydney. Hi, Maria.
Hello to you both.
Hey. Maria, we, you know, any relatively self-aware shopper is aware of a whole range of supposedly ethical products on our shelves. You know, we can buy fair trade coffee, we can buy cage-free eggs, we can buy eco-friendly bottled water. Is the possibility that's often marketed as ethical tourism, is that just another one of those things in this sequence, or is it something that's a bit more complicated than we're maybe led to believe?
It's definitely part of the larger provision of ethical products across the market. So it's definitely a part of that larger creation of an ethical self that we invest in all the time. But I think what we do see in tourism is that there are lots of other factors in play. So there are histories of colonialism that we engage in. There are sort of ongoing patterns of colonial power that we engage in as well. So it becomes a lot more controversial because of that. And people tend to call out volunteer tourism or ethical tourism on those factors a lot more than you would with fair trade products, for example, because they're still locked in our first world spaces.
So but we don't
there
seem,
is, you know, great complexity. Now go on.
I didn't realise you were going on. But we don't actually seem to call out tourism that isn't trying to be ethical. So the holiday resort, I felt as I was thinking this, I was having some highly original thought. Now, I'm sure someone somewhere has written about it, but this is hardly a popular conversation that we have.
Oh, well, there's actually been a lot of media interest in the sort of complexities of ethical tourism, as well as resort tourism and the more kind of mainstream kinds of tourism. So because of the expansion of that product range of ethical tourism products, we do actually see a lot of people saying, oh, look, people just do it to put it on their CVs or, you know, make themselves seem more ethical on their social media profiles. And that's definitely true as well. So I do think that we get a lot more interest now in terms of critiquing and reflecting on that ethical product range.
Look, can I take us back to first principles for a moment here? Because, you know, as you both know, I've got a kind of internal monologue with Aristotle all the time. and I mean, Aristotle was convinced that the first and only question of all moral issues is what is the purpose? What is the goal? And it's the goal that then orients us and sustains us throughout our ethical inquiry. I'm really interested in knowing from you, Maria, what do you think is the point of tourism, or even broadening it a little bit, the point of going on holiday. What are holidays for?
Well, there's definitely the reasons that have always been a part of travelling. So things like a search for authenticity and a search for meaning, as well as a reason to get away from your ordinary life and a search for escape. But recently, we've seen a really big trend towards what's called the instrumentalisation of travel. So that's basically when people use their holiday experiences to create work and entrepreneurial outcomes. And that's, you know, everything from people taking selfies on luxury holidays to add to their personal branding on social media to actually putting the volunteering trip on their CV. So they're actually using their holidays a lot more in terms of generating work outcomes.
Yeah, but sorry, I mean, if you're in any way sort of ethically self-aware, it seems to me that you cannot help but go to a place of either relative or extreme deprivation or with some history of colonial involvement. It seems to me, in my limited experience, you go to these places and you have to try really hard not to feel guilty about being there, not to stand out, not to simply be a tourist. I'm just wondering, can that experience of guilt, can that even be something that's redeemable, that's ethically salvageable?
Well, I think it can go one of two ways. So I think you can either react to that guilt by pushing it away and pushing away any of the discomfort that comes around it. But I think the other way that I've seen a lot of tourists do is to actually engage in the discomfort and lean into it. And I think, you know, I've seen tourists do everything from set up fundraisers back at home, as well as like set up NGOs to help causes and projects that they've seen overseas, just because they've gone through a process of feeling guilty, feeling discomforted, and actually leaning into it and thinking about the wider processes of colonial power that are a part of that discomfort. So I think there's a lot that people do actually do out of that process of discomfort and leaning into it.
I feel like we're missing something in the middle, though, here. That there has to be a form of holiday making that is just about fun and relaxing and all those sort of things that are the reasons we go for holidays, that don't necessarily have to take on all of the moral quandaries of the world and try to solve them. We can do that when we're not on holiday, perhaps, but I feel like there has got to be more a template for the ordinary taking of holidays that is just at least a little bit more engaged. So here, for example, is what I'm worried about. If you took my concerns to the logical extension and said that we should be engaging in the kinds of travel that express themselves in these volunteer tourism type arrangements, then what would actually happen is anyone who doesn't want to work on their holiday would end up going only to enormously familiar, very culturally similar places. Everyone would be going to New York and London, and that would pretty much be that. And so it would collapse any sense, really, of curiosity that we might have about the world, because everyone would be too petrified that if they went somewhere that was a little less familiar, that they would somehow be doing it wrong. And so I guess my concern with the resort is that it facilitates us travelling to these places that are not culturally familiar, but then it works so hard to erase anything that isn't culturally familiar. There has to be some kind of place in the middle that doesn't impose onerous obligations on the traveller such that people will cease to want to travel, but somehow leave the traveller enriched beyond just being relaxed.
Right. Well, I definitely do think that what you've raised about the resorts is extremely concerning. So I think what you're kind of suggesting is particularly that all-inclusive model of the resort where you don't have to go outside at all is particularly damaging. So I think, you know, obviously NGOs have raised problems about those all-inclusive resorts. They definitely do not share the profits of tourism, you know, with local communities. So when you're looking for another alternative, I think it's just about sort of rethinking our entitlement to get away without being bothered. So I don't think we necessarily have an entitlement to that middle space where we don't get bothered, where we don't necessarily have to think about these things. I think we do have to think about these things when they come up. We're not allowed to go on holiday without thinking about the people's livelihoods that that affects.
Wow. Waleed. So there. Yeah, that's the closest thing to a guest smackdown
wanted to ask, you know, because this idea that it's not morally justifiable, and I totally understand, and I kind of do agree with it, that it's not morally justifiable to go away to these resorts. And, you know, we've all done it once or twice, but, you know, we feel guilty about it. Look, isn't that kind of entrance into an exclusive first world space something that we do every day? I mean, we go into spaces like that in Australia and we lock out the disadvantage that exists in this country when we go into first world spaces. So isn't that idea of going into spaces like that inevitable for a first world person?
Yeah, I think there's truth to that, but I think there is a difference. So if, for example, I live in a first world country and I live in a lot of first world spaces, I do still have to grapple with that in some way or other, because these conversations will be broadcast on a national radio station, for example, or I will encounter them in public conversation at work, or there will be forums in which these things are somehow raised. The thing I think that makes the resort qualitatively different is it's the removal of all forums. It's a sanitized forum, sanitized entirely for your protection. And yes. I think that's kind of, there's a qualitative difference there, isn't there?
Well, I think what you're talking about is the extreme of the resort model. So that all-inclusive model where you definitely don't have to go outside at all and you won't be doing any day trips or anything like that. And absolutely, I do agree with criticism of that, because that is really damaging to tourist communities and the economies around it as well, as the moral side of things.
But leaving economics to the side, and I realise that sort of economics and ethics here really can't be easily separated, but just thinking for a moment about the soul of the tourists themselves, you know, which is a strange thing to say, but, you know, there does come this moment in moral development that's crucial, that where everything hinges, where you effectively become a stranger to yourself, where the various things that you've always taken as simply given, as simply the way things are, if you like, get suspended. I mean, that can be a moment of radical injustice. That can be a moment confrontation of radical otherness. And it seems to me that you can never quite escape entirely from that ethical commandment whenever one ventures outside of some place where things are simply given. And so it would seem to me that the obligation of any holiday like that would be to, you must expose yourself to that moment where you simply see, I'm the one who's in fact strange here, and the things that I've taken as given are simply contingent. Things could be otherwise and perhaps should be otherwise.
Yeah, which is a very interesting thought, and possibly one of the reasons why I have less problem with the idea of a resort in Queensland. for example, because I think it's a different cultural dynamic. Maria, will you please hang around to have this conversation in a more extended form for our podcast?
Absolutely.
Great. I hope so, because that was kind of the deal. Maria Colith has just completed her doctoral research on volunteer tourism at the Department of Gender and Cultural Studies at Sydney University. We're off to the news now, but we'll be back with the podcast very soon.
All right. One of the aspects of tourism that we really didn't talk about in that first part of the show was another expression where people visit sites not in order to be overwhelmed by local beauty or to lounge around at beaches or simply take in the highlights, but where tourists really do seek out places not of unimaginable beauty, but of mass atrocity. This is sometimes called dark tourism in some of its more sort of effete forms, but there are also extreme examples, sometimes called thanatourism, where you try to even relive or expose yourself in more radical, humiliating ways to some of the atrocities of the past. I've got real kind of moral concerns about this. You've done some research on this, Maria. I'm wondering, I mean, what are the ethical implications of that?
Yeah, so I think the ethical implications vary according to the actual place being visited because there are different histories involved. You know, I've done research on visits to the sites of the Khmer Rouge atrocities in Cambodia, so that's a very specific history that we can sort of look at. But, you know, the wider sort of move towards visiting these spots isn't actually that questionable in the sense that people do actually visit them to commemorate these things happening and actually learn about the history of atrocities. And I think that's incredibly important, you know, just for preventing that happening again so that people remember what happened. So that's the wider sort of motive behind it.
Yeah, I've got to say, Scott, I don't share your concern with that at all. In fact, I would have thought that some of my, I don't know, most important moments of reflection have come as a result of that kind of thing. You know, being in Berlin and seeing what the remnants of the wall and becoming more immersed in that kind of thing than you really would ever be by watching a documentary or reading a book or something like that. But and that, I guess, goes in a way, although it's a more extreme example, but it goes in a way to my objection about resort culture, is that I think immersion is an important aspect of the travel experience. And I don't think people are obliged to immerse themselves in things that are always necessarily serious. I just feel they should be immersing themselves in something.
Instead of remaining always that little bit removed and protected from the surrounds.
Well, determinedly so, yes.
But I do think, I mean, even some of these sites that we're talking about, and, you know, there are extreme examples, for instance, of thanatourism, where tourists pay in order to be treated like an inmate in a death camp, or themselves get to sleep in bunks over the night. And there are even extreme examples where they then get the opportunity of being marched by fake capos to some sort of death chamber or gas chamber. So, you know, there are these sort of commodifications, if you like, of horror. But I'm also wondering about, I mean, I think Germany is at the best, most moral end of the spectrum here, as is Poland. But, I mean, what about the selective memorialization of certain sites, for instance, in Cambodia, Maria, where you know, it's not as if the modern Cambodian government has its hands entirely free or clean in terms of its past, and yet there's quite a lot made of the memorialization and the maintenance of certain sites around the country.
That's true, and I think especially, you know, I've heard so many tourists about, you know, I've heard them talk about what they've learnt about the history of the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge regime, and they will know nothing about the contemporary practices of land clearing or exploitation carried out by the Cambodian government. And for a certain extent, paying respects to these one or two sites of atrocity really sort of obscures the larger sites of political upheaval that are sort of happening all across Cambodia. And that can be a really negative thing because it can force a sort of legitimacy, enforce legitimacy rather, on the Cambodian government and actually give them the capacity to say there's nothing going on here that's problematic, and everybody just needs to remember all the things that happened in the past that were problematic. So that can really be a really destructive force in terms of contemporary politics in Cambodia.
I guess one of my other concerns that I can see with that kind of tourism you're talking about there, Scott, is that it does, in the end, lead to a fairly flat conception of the place you're visiting, doesn't it?
Yes.
And so one of the great things about travel, particularly travel for leisure, is that you get to see things that are determinedly not news. Right? They will never be reported. They will never be recorded in history books because they are not in and of themselves interesting, but actually comprise the great majority of the social reality in existence for the people that are actually there. You get to know what, you know, the way they talk to each other, the way that they eat together or not, the way that their shops look, all of these sorts of things that create a more fully human picture of the people that you're, you know, in whose midst you are. And that can easily go by the wayside, can't it? If you're really quite set upon viewing a place through a very particular narrow prism.
And look, I think that's an amazingly important point, Waleed. And one of the things that I suppose has concerned me for quite some time is, if I can put it really crassly, the implicit racism that's already embedded in much of the mainstream media's foreign news reporting, where we descend on a place when everything goes to hell and then leave when something like normality returns. And I think that sense that we know how to do leisure, we know how to have peaceful consumption, whereas other places only know sort of death, destruction, chaos, political unrest, or whatever. And I wonder if one of the implicit, or perhaps it should be explicit, moral injunctions with any overseas travel should be: get to know what a normality other than your own might be like. Get to know what a sociability other than your own might be like. And hopefully that then kind of cleanses somewhat, if you like, the jaded palate of so much kind of Western media consumption, where we cannot imagine these places as anything other than nightmares. Is there something in that, Maria, or is this sort of overstating it?
No, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right that has to be a part of our travel, that getting to know a normality, not just of that place that you're going to, but also how that normality affects your normality every single day. You know, I heard from tourists in Cambodia that they took note of the fact that all the sites that they went to visit were surrounded by factories making clothes for back home. You know, so this kind of normality is actually, you know, interact and they overlap in really important ways.
Is there anything convincing to my inclination not to have a moral objection to resorts in places like Australia? Or is there something intrinsic here that I'm overlooking? Am I applying a double standard of some kind?
I feel it's a little bit of a double standard because we know that disadvantage is organised differently these days. It doesn't just exist in so-called third world countries. It exists all across the world. There are people living in third world conditions in Australia, and it's really terrible, and it's something that we completely don't think about. So anytime we go to a space that has no indication of these kinds of realities, you know, we're entering a space of exception, and we're entering a space of moral questionable, you know, morally questionable realities. Yep.
But that would make it morally questionable just to go to work.
It does, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you have to change your life then.
But what we're effectively then asking is everybody's life to become about nothing more than encountering spaces of disadvantage, which I think I'm not convinced.
Well, that's not true. I think it's about balance. And I think, you know, what I've seen people do is engage in an ethical struggle of trying and failing and trying again to do better, to intervene in spaces of disadvantage better than they have. And we can't do it all the time. We have to, you know, collate our resources. We've got to work to make money to give to people, you know. So I think, you know, it's not about changing everything at once. It's about small little changes that people do make once they've been on a travel trip that actually makes them rethink their lives, or they've just seen something on the TV that makes them rethink their lives.
Right. But if it's about balance, then surely, you know, the odd trip to the Whitsundays is fine. It seems to me that what isn't objectionable about that in that case is that if you are Australian, you are immersed in the quandaries, the circumstances of Australia every day, and you're not dealing with a situation in a place like that where Australian culture is being commodified and repackaged for somebody else. You know what I mean? I feel like the moral calculations are actually quite different because of that. Now, if what you're saying is we need to live lives that are more attentive to disadvantage in our midst, then I will raise no argument against that. But to say that that must then stretch across every single thing we do, including leisure time and holidays, I'm just not... I'm not sure I see why the argument necessarily leads us to that extent.
I think the argument leads there because if we really want to be good travellers or just good people at home, you know, we really have to think about challenging systemic patterns of colonial power, you know, on a wide scale basis and changing those things. And we don't do that overnight, but thinking about it more and thinking about how we can change our lives to respond to it more actually creates cumulative change that can add up over time. So I do think that there's no space in which we're sort of given a free pass, entitled to not think about it. You know, we're not going to think about it all the time, but the spaces that we do think about it, I mean, are legitimate.
There are three things here that really stand out for me. One is, you know, we all know that capitalism centralizes. So the idea that more and more, you know, more and more options will proliferate and we'll have genuine competition among them. We all know that's not true. But I think seeing resorts as one of those forms of centralization and one of those forms of culturally extractive capitalism, I think that's, I mean, for me, this has been one of the real kind of compelling insights from what you've said, Maria, and also specifically what you suggested before, Waleed, that we have to work really, really hard, I think, to behave in ways that are genuinely supportive to local economies and local products. But there are two also more sort of abstract moral things for me. I mean, Freud very famously said that anxiety is a profoundly moral affect, that we all hate it and we all want to try to run away from it. But anxiety points to the truth for us. And the more we want to forget, the sort of more determinately it points to these things that we want to ignore. And I just wonder,
so you want anxious holidays.
Well, is moral anxiety escapable, or should moral anxiety be escapable? Now, you really do raise the important point, though, Willie. Do you really want to spend the entire time being so anxious and fraught with the consequences of what you do?
And is that a reasonable thing to ask of people needing a holiday?
Well, and this then raises the third point for me. I mean, we are one of the few generations that hasn't grappled with the morality of limits, of not having to know everything about the world, or not having to be aware of all of the different places around the world. You know, most serious moral philosophers from the 19th and first half of the 20th century urged people, especially in an age of mass media or popular newspapers, to be very, very careful what you learn about. Because the more you learn, the more that feeling of moral anxiety and the more the possibilities of moral agency become diluted. And so being quite, I wonder if you would even support this, Maria, maybe not, but being more focused about what we expose ourselves to, about the things that we become morally anxious about, so that we can be more focused and have better moral agency in the way that we respond to those. I mean, isn't this part of the prescription?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues there. So I think that idea of being more focused can be really productive. I don't think we can necessarily cut off ourselves from learning about things, anxiety-inducing things, you know, across the world, because we're so exposed in terms of our media environment, that's very difficult, especially for younger generations who are very exposed to things happening around the world.
All the more so for them to be given permission not to expose themselves to certain things that are going on. I mean, the fact that it simply is, I think, is one of the things that we need to begin pushing back.
Well, especially because it's so voluminous, it's unlearnable.
That's right.
Yeah.
Is it? Is it just a different kind of learning?
No, I think it is unlearnable.
Right.
Feel free to tell me I'm wrong, but it just seems so vast at the moment. For you to read the front page of a newspaper and actually understand what that's saying would probably take you 5 years.
Hmm. Right. Well, I do think that what we're not recognising here is that along with the anxiety comes all sorts of other sort of emotions as well. So when people do actually pay attention to any one issue and they, say, go to a fundraiser for it or create a positive connection with it, there's also kinds of love and gratitude and giving that kind of interrupt and actually sort of remediate that anxiety a little bit. You know, don't get rid of it, but they do actually sort of mediate that. So I think there's ways in which we become more attached to certain issues as opposed to others. And those are things that are results of actions that we take and ethical actions that we invest in. So I think there are ways to mediate that anxiety, and people are actually creating those ways to do that.
Nice.
Maria, it's been such a thrill. Thank you very much for helping us out. I feel like I need a break after all that.